You're listening to Shift in Action, a program of wisdom media and spirited exchange offered through the Institute of Noetic Sciences. For more information, visit www.shiftinaction.com.
Welcome to Shift in Action with Stephen Dynan. This program offers you weekly inspiration with innovative ideas and practical solutions from some of today's brightest minds. Now, here's your host, Stephen Dynan.
Welcome to the program this week. You are listening to Shift in Action, and I am just delighted to have our guest today. Her name is Hazel Henderson, and she's one of the world's most respected evolutionary economists, and her bio literally stretches for pages, and involving editorials in 27 languages and books, and she co-founded Ethical Markets Media and was an executive producer of its TV series, and has really just been a pioneer in so many facets of new economic thinking. And personally, I think that we need to figure out a way to get Hazel to have the ear of President Obama. So, Hazel, thank you so much for joining us here today.
Oh, thank you, Stephen. That's so kind of you. Well, we just keep, you know, struggling along here, you know, with our alternative media. And, you know, it's all a matter, really, of bypassing Wall Street, bypassing the mainstream, and getting the new ideas out there.
Yeah, absolutely. So today I'm hoping that in our brief hour together, you can help shed some light on, you know, the current economic crisis. What are the real sources of it, and what are the opportunities? And do so in a way that you've been so good at translating complex economic topics into a frame that normal people who are not versed in economic theory can understand, and really start to understand why we have these systemic problems and what the great opportunity is today.
Well, you know, the real crisis that we have is a crisis of perception. I mean, you know, it's a very tragic thing that this very narrow group of people, you know, in what I call the global casino, have inflicted so much pain on so many other people around the world, you know, who are completely innocent. But I think that basically it's a matter of realizing that the way they're trying to go about it right now, all of the old economics insiders, is going to be very, very difficult, really, to make anything happen. And so how do we get the new mindsets, the new ideas, and the new people in play? This, I must confess, Stephen, I haven't the foggiest idea of what to do, you know, because you have Larry Summers in there whispering into Obama's ear, and he was the one who was really the architect of the credit default swap mess. And back in the 1990s, the head of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, a woman called Brooksley Bourne, actually went and testified on Capitol Hill and said these credit default swaps are going to blow up the global economy. And it was Larry Summers and his mentor, Robert Rubin, who was then Secretary of the Treasury, that severely criticized her and actually went to Congress and said, okay, we're going to pass a law that says that you really cannot regulate such instruments as credit default swaps. And as you know, they're still at the heart of this problem. And what we see happening right now, you know, where we're looking at these so-called stress tests of banks and all the rest of it, those speculators are still out there buying more credit default swaps, betting on which bank is going to fold, going to fail the stress test. So as long as you have these speculators out there and all these short sellers, you know, there's not very much can be done about it. Now, the Securities and Exchange Commission, the new person in there, Mary Shapiro, she is going to bring back the uptick rule, which was passed back in the 1930s after the Great Depression, which simply said that you couldn't keep selling into a down market. That was what created the great bear raids, you know, where the market would drop hundreds of points in a single day. So that uptick rule was repealed in July of 2007, And then, of course, we saw all the havoc that that short selling created. So really what I'm saying is that we have to start in a different place. And I'd like to talk some more about that.
Yeah, I want to go deeper into that. So just to clarify from my own understanding, so the uptick rule basically prevents people from pushing the market lower in a way to kind of drive prices lower in order to keep short selling. So they make money off driving the market lower.
Yes, that's exactly right. Like a short seller is somebody who sells stocks that they don't own. And, you know, it's rather like taking a bet on your neighbor's house that it will have a fire and then going and lighting a match. I mean, you know, it's disgusting. I mean, a lot of these things, you know, the same with the credit default swaps. They're simply bets on the misfortunes of others, of third parties. And, I mean, basically a lot of very sensible people who I agree with in the industry think they should just be outright banned. You know, this should be illegal. But it'll take a long time because Wall Street still has such tremendous hold over the Congress and even over this new administration, unfortunately. So, you know, we can't hold our breath. We have to, I believe, put all of our efforts into growing the green economy because that will be a new set of players. And it will help with a stabilizing climate and environment and public health. And so it seems to me that that's what I spend most of my time doing.
Great. Well, I want to go deeper into that, how to jumpstart that green economy more later in the show. But first, also want to just get that deeper understanding of why we have the crisis that we do with one thing that struck me in reading some of your articles was you pointing out that a healthy financial sector really shouldn't comprise more than 10% of an economy, and we now have created these huge financial bubbles of 25% of the economy is wrapped up in these financial instruments and derivatives. And
yes, absolutely. And, I mean, you can see it very plainly. It's exactly the same thing that happened in the run-up to the Great Depression in the 1920s. What it was more and more traders on Wall Street were pyramiding assets and trading them back and forth between each other on the backs of the real productive economy, the people who are out there, you know, making real furniture and shoes and whatever. And those things always come to grief. And so I was just reading the other day, and you know, I usually use the number 25% of the GDP, which is really crazy. And that's the same in Britain, where I grew up. And, of course, when a sector like that crashes, it brings the whole economy down with it. And apparently in the last few months of 2007, the size of the financial sector had actually grown to 40% of the GDP. That was the only part of the economy that was making money. And of course, as you know, Stephen, money is different from wealth. Mm-hmm. And so they were making lots of money, you know, those green pieces of paper or electronic blips on their computer screens. But it had nothing to do with wealth. The real wealth of the real productivity going on in the real economy. And so this is the paradigm shift, really, is getting back to the real world.
Mm-hmm. And part of that, it seems like we need to have a deeper understanding of money itself. Like we have a kind of a warped psychology around it and see it as a scarce commodity and a variety of things that really just aren't helpful to transition to this more a solar age economy, as you've talked about.
Yes. Well, you know, this is the most fundamental level of the paradigm shift, is when people come to realize that money is created. You know, it didn't come from God. And it was a very brilliant human invention. And if money is created properly and well managed, it can serve as a good store of value and a means of transacting between people. But if money creation gets out of control, then you know, you end up in the kind of mess that we are. And so basically we really have to go back now and look at the Federal Reserve Act of 1913, which was put together by the banking industry kind of in the dead of night. And basically, it's the private banking industry that pretty much controls monetary policy through the Federal Reserve. The actual board, the seven members of the Federal Reserve Board, including the chairman, are the only public officials. All the rest of it really are the private banks in the 12 Federal Reserve districts. And so they have this weird idea that the government lends them money, and then they lend it out at interest 10 times over. It's called the fractional reserve banking system. And what we don't realize is that all of our money, almost all of our money now is created as debt. In other words, money is created when somebody goes into a bank and gets a mortgage and of $100,000, say, and the bank says, okay, you can have this mortgage. All they do is to write $100,000 figures into the borrower's account, and presto, there is $100,000 of new money created in the system. And so what ends up, what this kind of a system ends up doing is creating what we have today, a country which is absolutely, run on larger and larger amounts of debt. And actually, on our TV website, ethicalmarkets.tv, we have a very nice little video cartoon called Money is Debt. And if people have the patience to sit through 45 minutes, they'll learn everything they ever need to know about how money is created and the simple ways that we can correct it.
And so what in a nutshell are the recommendations about what should we do about the Federal Reserve and fractional reserve banking?
Well, you really have to go back and say that the money cannot be created by private profit-making banks. Money in the Constitution should be created by the Congress, i.e. directly by the Treasury, and spent into the economy in that way. Now, normally the banking industry has had enough clout, particularly on Capitol Hill, to say, oh, no, we can't leave money creation to these dreadful politicians because they'll create, inflation and all the rest of it. But now we see what private money creation has done, and now we see the Federal Reserve Board printing money every night on TV, we realize that the way money is created is absolutely fundamental to the solutions that we're looking for. And so we have...
Let me have you hold that thought. We do need to go to a commercial break here.
Okay.
We're talking with Hazel Henderson on reforming the global casino. I hope you can join us after the break. Welcome back to the program. We are with Hazel Henderson, and we are talking with Hazel about how to move beyond the Federal Reserve banking and fractional reserve banking system and really have a different view of money, so that it's no longer created as debt, but that is more adequately encouraging this green economy. So maybe, Hazel, if you can just pick up from there.
Yes, definitely. Well, so, I mean, the job one is to downsize the current financial sector back to less than 10% of the GDP, which obviously means breaking up these big banks. And some of that discussion is beginning to happen now. You know, there's people on the Hill now talking about bringing back Glass-Steagall, which never should have been repealed. The Glass-Steagall Act was enacted right after the Great Depression got going, and It said basically that you couldn't have these big kind of banks that were created right after it was repealed, like Citibank, where they tried to do insurance and brokerage and banking and everything else all rolled into one. And that was what began the instability, which ended up in the crisis that we have today. And all Glass-Steagall said was that banks who take deposits on Main Street from ordinary, you know, citizens cannot do anything else but just be plain vanilla local bankers and take those deposits and loan them out to good, stable local borrowers. And then it said insurance had to be a completely separate industry, and that investment banking was something completely different again, and that brokerage, stock brokerage, should also be completely separate. So those were the four pillars of a financial sector, but that never the twain should meet. And, of course, with a lot of lobbying from the banking and financial industry, that was repealed, unfortunately, and that's why we got in the mess we're in. And it was largely Citibank that decided they would put all of their lobbying weight behind repealing Glass-Steagall, and they succeeded during the Clinton administration. So basically, to get back to how do we go forward from here, if we can create and grow a local homegrown economies again, because that's what really this is all about. It got too highly centralized, and the thinking around President Obama and on the, in the Congress right now is the idea that the only way you can solve the financial problem is to pour money into the top of these enormous banks, and somehow it'll trickle down to Main Street. And, of course, we all know that that's not happening. And so the main difference is to begin to help the local economies. And the interesting thing is that most of the local banks are just fine, because they never got into subprime mortgages. They never got into all these fancy derivatives and structured investment vehicles, and all of the local credit unions, the same. Most of them are okay. But whatever's left in that TARP fund, if it were given out to local banks and credit unions, that would be the way to start.
So really, and ideally, this would be combined with reform of the Federal Reserve System, so that it wouldn't even be that the federal government would have to borrow this money to spend
exactly.
into the local
yes,
economies,
exactly.
but it actually could create it and spend it in.
Yes, and the model really, there is one bank, which is the model, and I have an article on our website on this. It's the Bank of North Dakota, and it's the only bank in the United States which actually operates on this basis. In other words, the government of North Dakota, the state, owns that bank, and any publicly funded and democratically passed project, whether it's new schools or roads or mass transit or whatever, gets funded by the Bank of North Dakota at no interest. Because why should people pay interest to themselves? You see, whereas when we got the private banks involved, they make an enormous amount of interest. And for most municipal projects in the U.S., we feel that the only thing we can do is to go to a bank and or float our bonds on Wall Street at some very high interest rate. And this is the municipal bond market. But there is no need to pay interest if you have it, if you have money created as it was intended in the U.S. Constitution, in the case of North Dakota, by the state of North Dakota itself. And we could do that. Every state in the union could do that. And we could have the same thing where the Treasury creates the money, and instead of giving it to the Fed, and then the Fed lends it out to these banks, and then they make private interest on it. Instead of that, the Treasury would spend the money directly into the economy, like for all the mass transit and the green economy initiatives that are in the current stimulus. So it's quite simple to reform this, but the big thing is to do what you're doing on this program, Stephen, is getting a discussion going in the public about how to do this.
I'd never heard that piece about that state governments could effectively do this as well. We get so focused on the changing the federal system, but that you can actually have a more local
absolutely.
Local strategy.
Yes. Yes, go take a look. You can Google up the Bank of North Dakota, and it'll show you how it's done. And of course, that's one of the very few states in the union that doesn't have any debt. You know, here's California going bankrupt, and half of the other states in the union are going bankrupt. Why? Because they borrow money in the private bond market mm-hmm. and pay all of this unnecessary interest, where there could be the Bank of California up there in Sacramento, and it could create these kind of projects itself without issuing bonds.
Fascinating. And so, and one thing I read in one of the articles is that a lot of green economy projects like large wind installations would become all of a sudden cost competitive with coal and other technology or fossil fuel economies if you remove the interest part of the equation.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Not to mention all of the other real costs of coal and fossil fuels, you see, because the way the old economics still is used is they say, oh, well, coal is cheapest. Not if you add all of the health costs of asthma and the mercury poisoning and all of the other pollutants and the CO2 and cutting off the tops of mountains. If those, as economists call them, quote-unquote externalities, which is kind of like a Freudian slip, isn't it? You know, it's those things that we don't want to pay attention to, right, on our balance sheet. If all those things were actually included in the cost of constructing a coal-fired power plant, a coal would be one of the most expensive forms of energy. And, of course, with wind and solar, once you've done the capital cost setting up those plants, the fuel is free. It's sunlight and wind power. And so this is why I spent most of my life deconstructing what was wrong with economics, Stephen.
Thank God you have really
it was so weird, you know, that I figured, okay, you know, so I ended up writing all those books about it because, you know, one of the problems we have, you see, is we graduate too many economists. And we have, you know, these departments of economics in universities are the most well-funded, you know, and it's rather like lawyers, you know. Like we have 40 times as many lawyers per capita as they do in Japan. I mean, we probably have 40 times more economists per capita than we have in any other country in the world. Hmm. And so they all need to be retrained.
Right, and a lot of them are based upon this kind of laissez-faire Chicago school.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
And so you end up with a bit of a herd effect. So ideas
yes.
like you're talking about aren't common enough yet that they make it through.
Yes, and so, you know, they control the public debate to a tremendous extent just because there's so darn many of them, you know, and of course then they lobbied legislators all over the world to say that central banks must be insulated from politics and they must be independent even of the most democratically elected politicians. And of course now we realize, hey, you know, when you've got the Federal Reserve that shoveled all that money out to AIG and then had the nerve to tell us that it wasn't going to tell us how the money was spent, and we now know that AIG was just used as a funnel, and all that money was funneled right back to Goldman Sachs and the Deutsche Bank, you know, were to pay 100% on the dollar for their credit default swap bets.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, why do we think that central banks are going to be any better at managing our monetary affairs than having the Treasury do it directly? So anyway, all of this stuff is getting on the table, and it's all part of the opportunity that we have in this meltdown to ask some of these really fundamental questions, not only what's wrong with economics, but, hey, shouldn't we correct the GDP? And, of course, this has been another thing of mine. That's the gross domestic product. You know, that it doesn't account for all of the bads that come along with the goods, you know, the pollution and all of the external effects that impact society, they're just not counted in GDP. And so naturally, if you exclude all of the pollution and the side effects, and you exclude all of the production that's unpaid in what I call the love economy, and in every society, about 50% of all of the productive work and activities is unpaid.
So, Hazel, we are going to need to go to a break here. Let's hold that thought about the reforming the GDP. And, folks, I hope you can return with us in a few moments. Welcome back, everyone. We are with Hazel Henderson. And Hazel, I'd love to continue in this segment by really focusing strongly on solutions and those inspiring organizations and new initiatives that really hold the promise of not just putting a bandage on the old economy, but really fundamentally helping us grow a new green one. So,
absolutely, yes. This is my passion. And, I mean, the good news is now that as a result of all of this, we have in many, many countries, and of course this was a commitment in the G20 meeting in London, to this kind of Green New Deal. And the United Nations, several of the big agencies of the United Nations have started a Green Economy Initiative. And there's many other groups like the Global Marshall Plan that comes out of Europe, which is talking about growing a green, clean economy. And so all of this stuff, including correcting the scorecard from GDP to quality of life, all of this is going on all over the world now, which is really very exciting. And, you know, a good friend of mine who is a writer, Guy Dauncey, just sent me something which I'm going to post on our site. And he's saying, you know, everybody's talking about the cost of the green economy, and nobody has done any calculations about all of the avoided costs and the money that will be saved. And so here's his bullet points: eliminating the need to buy oil from the Middle East and defending our quote oil supply. This is what would happen if we move to the green economy. That includes $825 billion annual saving. And then by eliminating all of the pollution and smog from fossil-fueled vehicles and coal-fired power plants and da-da-da, and all of the gasoline cars, that adds up to $690 billion a year. And then by reducing our energy use very, very easy by 15%, you know, the American Council for Energy Efficient Economy says we can very easily reduce it by 30%, that raises another $338 billion. So what we have here is $1.7 trillion a year, every year. That would be our dividend from moving to a green economy. Oh. And so it's just totally amazing, isn't it? And of course, this is one of the biases of the old economics, is they're very, very good at identifying the costs, but they rotten at identifying the avoided costs. They don't
think
that way.
Because the things that you just take for granted as a householder in just our own daily life, we're not doing at all on a national level like that. If we can say, I mean, if you told the average householder they could save $100,000 a year by doing X, Y, and Z, it would be done by next week.
Exactly. And, of course, what's happening now is people are beginning to get it, you know, like with that new television channel, Planet Green, where you see exactly how much money you can save with energy efficiency and, you know, going greener in your daily life. And so, you know, but that's what we really need to do is to promote that figure, that $1.7 trillion a year, which we would save if we went green.
So then you can justify putting, if you put a few hundred billion into that, you've got a 10x return on your money every year.
And you see what I mean? You have to turn the old economics upside down in order to do this. So basically what we are doing here is bypassing Wall Street. you know, forget about trying to reform Wall Street. Yes, let them get on with that, you know, on Capitol Hill. But bypassing Wall Street and those big failing banks is so easy. The easiest way to do it, and this is happening all over the country, is electronic stock exchanges. And these are private exchanges, and they can be done at any level. You could have a private network like that in your own hometown, which would match local investors to local investment opportunities. And so these are springing up all over the country. And then, of course, there is the Business Alliance for Local Living Economies, and this is a network all over the country and in Canada of small businesses in most communities now who are dedicated to nurturing a homegrown economy. And so the other things that are spreading are land trusts, which make housing affordable for people. And one of the pioneers of this is the Schumacher Society, with whom I work very closely. They are up in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, and they have a real working model of how these land trusts enable families to own homes that are half the price that they would be if they were in the normal real estate market, even with what's going on now, you know, with all of these foreclosures. And then another thing which is taking off all over the country is contract-supported agriculture, where people in local towns get together with farmers and contract with farmers to grow the kind of vegetables and produce that they want and like. And then, of course, farmers markets, which are taking off all over the place. I must say that we buy all of our fresh fruit and vegetables, eggs, everything like that, from our local farmers market. And credit unions, they've been there for 100 years. I mean, you know, if you're better off to put your money in a local bank or a credit union, then and then you really know that it's going to support the local neighborhood. And then the other kind of thing which is growing all over the place are barter clubs. And, of course, there's the sites like Craigslist and Freecycle, but lots of local barter exchanges. And, of course, I can talk some more about this in the next segment, and that is the rise of local currencies. And they're now getting all kinds of national media attention.
We do have a little time before the next break, so I wonder if you could go deeper into that with the local currencies. Since
we
essentially have a debt-driven national currency that's somewhat bankrupted in many levels. What was the promise of these local currencies?
Well, the local currency idea is, look, if you have some kind of contraction of credit or the money supply of the regular federal dollars, then the best way to match needs and resources and employ people at the local level is to have a local currency in the other pocket. And that's exactly what they did at the Schumacher Society in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. And they started a currency called Berkshares. And this money is absolutely beautiful. And it's made by local artists, and it's printed on the same paper that your dollar bills are printed on. It looks really lovely. So you can go to any one of about six banks in that local area, and you put down 100 federal dollars, and you put down 90 federal dollars, and you get back 100 Berkshares. And the Berkshares will be accepted by most of the businesses in that town, in this case Great Barrington, so that you can go to restaurants and health clubs and use your Berkshares and keep your federal dollars in the other pocket for when you really need them. And so there is now over $1 million of these Berkshares are circulating around in the Great Barrington. And what they do is employ local people. And so there are many, many other local currencies all across the country. And as a matter of fact, in my TV series, I did highlight some of them in one of the programs that we had, and they're all up at ethicalmarkets.tv anytime you want to look at them.
Fascinating. And I also know there's the some exciting new development with person-to-person lending, or with some people micro-lending,
yes,
as well as interesting.
Yes, absolutely. There's this one called Prosper.com, and if you can't get a loan from a bank, you go to Prosper.com and you make an offer of what you need and post it up there, and local people will come back to you and say, okay, I'm willing to lend it to you at X amount of interest, and the two parties get together offline, you know, and decide when they've checked each other out about the loan. And there's one in Britain called Zopa.com, and a new one has just started in China called Kifang. And this will be mostly students wanting loans. You know, there's like, I'm trying to think how many million Chinese students there are every year, several million. And so this is a way where they can borrow some of their student fees. So you see, what we're talking about here is the benefits of the information age, that we don't need to centralize all of this activity on Wall Street and in great big banks anymore.
So basically what happens is when we centralize, we raise the potential for abuse. So we've created this big bubble of an inflated financial sector because, you know, people are intermediaries when they don't really need to be.
Yeah, and of course, when you're intermediaries and you don't know the real people you're dealing with in face-to-face, the whole thing gets very abstract, and then they bring in these rocket scientist mathematicians who turned out to be so stupid, you know, to create all of these weird derivative instruments and all of that. And it's what happens when you get away from face-to-face communities. You lose that transparency, and of course what happens with that is you lose the trust, and there's just too many opportunities for the kind of shenanigans, you know, that that went on Wall Street. So, I can remember a few years ago I served on a commission on the future of Florida.
We are going to need to go to break here again. Sorry about that. But we are speaking with Hazel Henderson, an evolutionary economist, and hope you can return after the break. Welcome back to the show. We are speaking with Hazel Henderson, noted evolutionary economist. And Hazel, we were talking before the break about just ways that we can start to create local exchanges of value and loans that help to break the current system where a lot of value is really sucked up by Wall Street.
Right, right. Bypassing Wall Street. That's my new motto. And I was just as an example, back in the 80s when I was serving on a commission on the future of my state here in Florida, I was saying to these legislators, now look, there is so much money in Florida, you know, so many retired people and all the rest of it. And why on earth do they all send their money to Wall Street? Why don't we have here in Tallahassee a Florida Venture Capital Network? And so they were going, well, duh, yeah, sure, why not, you know. So we've had that now in Florida for quite a long time. And you see, with the information age and or the ease of communicating now electronically, there is absolutely no need, you know, to have a Wall Street broker or to feel that you have to, you know, to defer to Wall Street. It can, so much of this done can be done locally. Now, for example, one of these electronic stock exchanges, which I discovered recently, and I think is very innovative, is in Chicago, and it's called Entrex, which means Entrepreneurs Exchange, and it's entrex.net. And what they've put together is an index of private companies, not like publicly traded companies like Standard & Poor's and the Dow and the Wiltshire. What they point out, quite rightly, is that all of those stock exchanges on Wall Street, they only really represent about, 5,000 companies. And yet, there are 500,000 absolutely wonderful small companies all over this country that create most of the jobs and are really the backbone of the whole country. So what they did was to comb through all of these statistics and everything else and come up with an index of the very best small local companies that don't have any intention of going public on Wall Street. And so you can look at their PCI, Private Company Index. And the interesting thing about it is, Stephen, is that that index outperforms every index on Wall Street, whether it's NASDAQ or the Dow, that these companies, you know, are much more valuable than most of the companies whose stock is traded on Wall Street.
So you can actually, the average investor can buy into a pool of these companies, or how does that work?
Well, they are putting together, and this is, they're just really launching this, a new asset class that will enable people to do just that. And if you go on the site, you can see that if a company wants to raise capital and can't go get it from the bank and doesn't want to give away equity to some greedy venture capitalist, what they can do is they can pledge like 1% of their top line income. And this is a kind of a new security, which is kind of a cross between a bond and a CD. And they have different maturities. And so they've gotten this thing through the SEC and everything else. And they are hoping to set up all kinds of funds composed of these new securities, which will enable people to buy into them and get good returns and at the same time allow these small companies to get the working capital they need without giving away their equity. So you see, there's so many innovators out there. It's absolutely amazing.
It really is inspiring when you hear about just the number of initiatives out there. So
yes, really amazing.
We've covered a lot of terrain today, and I think it's just been absolutely fascinating. And what I always like to do is end with some recommendations that you have for folks, just about the concrete steps they can make. And the way we've been framing this over the last weeks is asking the same question about what do you see as the five most important things that we can do individually to contribute to a global shift in the years ahead. And so maybe if we can just close with some of your practical,
all right. Well, these are all at different levels. The first thing is, you know, please go find a farmer's market in your area so you can support your local farmers and have all this delicious, fresh, organic, wonderful produce like what I and my partner enjoy every week. And then the second thing is to join a local green group. There must be one. There must be several local green groups that you would enjoy becoming a member of so that you can begin to help coordinate the kind of changes that may be needed in your town. I mean, you know, in my city of St. Augustine, Florida, with a population 18,000. We're finally dealing with our automobile problem. You know, we've built a big parking lot, parking garage outside of the city so that we can have more walking streets. And then what about have you asked your broker to find some green investments? And now is a really good time to pile into green investments because they have been battered down unbelievably by all these short sellers, because most of these little companies, you know, are traded over the counter and they wish they never had gone public because it's a very expensive thing to do. And then they've been hit by all of these short sellers, which hopefully pretty soon are going to be controlled. So the prices are very low. And you can find a lot of these green investments. We have newsletters on ethicalmarkets.com. On our green tech page. And then the other thing is, just like you were saying, Stephen, have you contacted your local representatives at every level and get involved in the policy process? This is really the time to put your shoulder to the wheel and make sure that, like, when the stimulus package arrives in your city, it doesn't go all to making new roads, but instead supports mass transit and bicycle paths and pedestrian options and all of those good things. So I think that if people could do that, and of course, you know, the other thing which people are doing more and more now is to just do those things in their own home, you know, the low head showers and toilets and changing those light bulbs. Those are kind of the no-brainer things that will save you money anyway.
Beautiful. Well, those are beautiful practical tips. And Hazel, I could talk to you all day. It's such a great education, and I just really I really appreciate your positive spirit about it all. You put to rest any notion that economics is just a dismal science, and really see, you really make it clear that this is understanding these realms is a pathway to really creating a better world. So thank you for all the work you're doing and for sharing your wisdom with us today.
Thank you so much, Stephen. Take care.
Great. And for folks who are available next week, we have a very exciting guest, Brian Johnson, who is the founder of Zods and the initiative called Philosopher's Notes. That's next Tuesday at 9 a.m. Pacific. I hope you can join us. And signing off here this week with Shift in Action.
Thank you again for joining us this week for Shift in Action. We hope you'll join Stephen Dinan again next Tuesday at noon Eastern Time, 9 a.m. Pacific Time on Voice America.
We hope you enjoyed this offering from the Shift in Action Partners Program and would like to sample more. Partners of the Institute of Noetic Sciences gain access to a weekly stream of inspiration, wisdom, media, and spirited exchange. The program includes live weekly teleseminars with visionaries who are lighting the way forward, Marilyn Schlitz, Dean Radin, Belvie Rooks, Larry Dossey, Candace Pert, Brian Swim, and many more. Our live teleseminars are then added to an extensive archive of audio and video on our website at www.shiftinaction.com, with new offerings each week from teachers like Marianne Williamson, Edgar Mitchell, and Louisa Tisch. The site offers the latest in community-building software that allows you to engage every piece of content as a focal point for education, exchange, and action. Join us in exploring the frontiers of consciousness.